Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Bob Hoffman from the Master Circle Global, and welcome to the Practice Upgrade Summit. We have another amazing interview today, and our topic is how not to diet. Our guest is Dr. Michael Greger. He's a founding member and a fellow of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. He's a physician, a New York Times bestselling author, and an international recognized speaker on nutrition. He has videos on more than 2,000 health topics that are freely available at nutritionfacts.org, with new videos and articles uploaded almost every single day. Dr. Greger has lectured at the Conference on World Affairs, testified before Congress, and was invited as an expert witness in the defense of Oprah Winfrey in the infamous meat defamation trial. He's a graduate of Cornell University School of Agriculture and Tufts University School of Medicine. Three of his recent books, How Not to Die and How Not to Die Cookbook and How Not to Diet, all became instant New York Times bestsellers. His latest book, How to Survive a Pandemic, was just released in May. All proceeds he receives from the sale of his books go to a charity. Welcome, Dr. Greger. It's an honor to have you on our call.
So glad to be here.
So glad to have you, and so thrilled to see you exercising while we're trying to exercise the minds and the thought process of the people watching.
Sounds good.
So let me dig right in. I know you're a big research guy, and I think that's so important. So how valuable is research for doctors to get their patients to be more compliant?
Well, I mean, the question is compliant with what? I mean, who cares if patients are compliant if you're asking them to do something that doesn't make any sense or won't help them at all or could even harm them? And so that's where research comes in. Research, you know, we look at the best available balance of evidence to suggest that the benefits outweigh the risks of any particular intervention in any particular case. And then we can ask for compliance. And the way we do that is just laying out the facts and letting our patients make up their own minds, their body, their choice. You know, they want to go, you know, smoke cigarettes or go bungee jumping, do whatever. Well, it's their choice. You know, all we as physicians can do is share with them our knowledge, our experience, our training, and say, well, you know, people in your circumstances that do X, Y, and Z, you know, the predictable consequences of those actions are thus. And then, you know, it's up to you.
But I'm sure if a physician or any doctor, any healthcare provider knew the research, they would have more certainty and more confidence in order to present to that patient and recommend properly, which I think by and large would just help the patient be more compliant on their recommendations. You would agree, wouldn't you?
Well, not necessarily. For example, studies show that when presented with drugs like high blood pressure medications or cholesterol lowering medications, people expect, in order to take a drug every day for the rest of their lives, they expect a certain amount of benefit in terms of reducing risk of a heart attack, for example. And when actually presented with the actual reduction in absolute risk that these drugs can give, assuming there's no change in lifestyle, most patients would not take those drugs. So the only way we can get our patients to take those drugs, which we want them to, because on a population scale, we could save millions of lives, even though the advantage for that particular patient may be vanishingly small. The only way we can do that is actually not fully inform the patient. That's the only way we can get them to take these drugs. And so actually giving them all the data may actually make them less compliant, which would be in their worst interest, because even if there's a, you know, 1 in 50 chance of them benefiting, which is typically what you see about a 2% absolute risk reduction. So for example, secondary prevention, someone's already had a heart attack, put people on a high dose statin drug over the next 5 years, about a 1 in 50 chance. So 49 out of 50 people won't benefit at all, but 1 out of 50, we may be able to prevent an event. And so for that person, that's on a population scale, millions of lives could be saved. Fantastic, amazing drugs. But for that individual, be like 1 in 50 chance, I don't want to take a drug that may give me muscle aches or may increase my risk of diabetes. There's just a 1 in 50 chance it's going to benefit me. So in that case, actually fully informing a patient about the risks and benefits may ironically make them do the opposite of what we actually want them to do for their health.
Well said. Well said. And thank you. I appreciate your perspective. So with all of your research, knowledge, and experience, provided we wanted to help someone get healthier, just in general, to live a better life, maybe even extend life, what's the healthiest diet?
The healthiest diet is one that's centered around whole plant foods. So minimizes the intake of meat, eggs, dairy, and junk, maximizes the intake of fruits, vegetables, legumes, which are beans, split peas, chickpeas, and lentils, whole grains, nuts and seeds, mushrooms, herbs, and spices, basically real food that grows out of the ground. These are our healthiest choices, from fields, not factories. That's where we should be getting most of our nutrition from.
I love it. And I love the concept, fields, not factories. I'm assuming you're also a big fan, if we're trying to get someone healthier, to recommend fasting. So what are some of the benefits of fasting and how would one go about it?
Well, there's all sorts of different types of fasting. That's why in my book, How Not to Diet, it's actually the largest chapter. So there's so many different types, particularly the intermittent fasting now. There's alternate day eating, 5-2 fasting, 25-5 fasting, mimicking diets, time-restricted feeding, on and on and on. They all have various benefits and risks, in addition to more traditional concepts of fasting, such as water-only fasting or modified fasting. And they all have various risks and benefits. For various conditions, probably the best documented in the literature would be kind of kickstarting an alleviation of high blood pressure, which could then be locked in by transitioning to a healthy diet after the fast.
Beautiful. And you touched on it with intermittent fasting, which I think is becoming more and more popular by the day. How would you recommend somebody properly intermittent fast?
Well, so I would not recommend alternate day fasting, which has been shown to actually increase cholesterol compared to the same amount of caloric restriction on a chronic day-to-day basis. We're not exactly sure what the mechanism behind that is, but that was the result of the largest, longest study done to date. So if you are going to do it, even though it hasn't been shown to improve compliance or improve, which was kind of the hope, I would make sure that you had your cholesterol monitored to make sure it doesn't go up. And so in terms of what would actually be the best, I think early time restricted feeding really has the best evidence to date. And so that's restricting your eating window to 12 hours or less, but then critically that eating window is shifted towards the morning rather than evening. If you're gonna skip any breakfast, any meal, you're skipping supper, not breakfast. And we're trying to shift our calories towards earlier in the day.
So someone would be consuming food for 6 or 8 hours and not consuming for 18 or 14 hours, something like that.
Right, but critically, when that window would be. So if you actually look at that time-restricted feeding literature, it's all over this place, with some showing benefit, some showing harm. And you say, wait a second, how could restricting people to the same 8 hours a day in the similar population of people be good sometimes and bad other times? And then you look a little deeper and you realize, it's the timing. So when people, that was stripped, a typical way to restrict is skipping breakfast. So you don't eat until like 11 or so. And so then you can, and then you finish eating by 7. And so, okay, so there's your 8 hours, right? That may be more convenient in terms of social outings, in terms of family. But the problem is then by shifting caloric intake later in the day, you have these negative metabolic consequences. So the better would be early time restricted feeding, those same 8 hours, but earlier in the day. And so you're having a very early supper. Then you get benefits of both the chronobiological benefits of eating earlier plus the time-restricted feeding benefits at the same time.
I had never heard of it like that, but that makes a ton of sense. You know, a lot of the people watching this, a lot of the doctors watching this are very much into brain health and brain fitness and improving cognitive outcomes. What are some of the most important foods for brain health from your perspective based on the research?
You know, it's really heart health is brain health. And in fact, and the reason why these chronic diseases seem to kind of come together is because they have a similar underlying cause. So for example, inflammation plays a role in so many different chronic diseases. And so an anti-inflammatory diet, that's how an anti-inflammatory diet can have beneficial effects, not only on, you know, overtly inflammatory conditions like rheumatoid arthritis, but also diabetes and cognitive decline, other things where you don't typically think of it as inflammatory. Another kind of underlying physiological effect is blood flow. So, you know, we think of improving blood flow to our heart, improving our arterial function, opening up arteries without drugs, without surgery, with a artery healthy diet. And that same diet not only reverses heart disease, but has been shown to reverse progression of prostate cancer and improve liver function, kidney function. You say, wait a second, how can one diet do all that? Well, all tissues of the body require oxygen, require nutrients, need to get rid of waste products. So no wonder that a blood flow healthy diet can have benefits to all organ systems, and the brain is no exception. You can do, you know, autopsy studies, and you can tightly correlate the amount of atherosclerosis in the cerebral arteries. These are the arteries tunneling through the brain, and cognitive decline. In fact, the tributaries that go directly to the memory centers of the brain, the amount of atherosclerosis in them tightly correlated to Alzheimer's and memory loss in general. And so you see this with back pain, you see this with a variety of conditions. And so cleaning out the arteries, atherosclerosis is not limited to the heart, but to your entire arterial tree. So no wonder why starving the brain of oxygen, one of the most metabolically active tissues in the body, would have detrimental effects. So heart healthy diet is a brain healthy diet.
And both heart and brain healthy diet, arterial healthy diet, is the same diet you talked about earlier.
Right. So it's a diet centered around plant foods, low in trans fats, saturated fats, and dietary cholesterol, the three things that increase our cholesterol levels, which is what gets stuck in the arterial line and causes the inflammation that starts clogging off our arteries. You're right. So that's the reason why we encourage people to eat a plant-based diet, the only diet ever proven to reverse the progression of heart disease in the majority of patients. That is the number one killer for both men and women around most of the Western world.
Beautiful, beautiful. Now, with the soil all over being so depleted of nutrients, even with this plant-based diet, do you normally recommend taking supplements of any kind? And if so, which ones?
Yeah, so, I mean, that whole trope is largely a disinformation campaign by supplement manufacturers who have this, you know, our soils are getting depleted, you're not gonna get enough minerals, and so here, take our mineral supplements. But, you know, this is actually studied by, I mean, so the USDA does crop surveys every 5 years. So you actually go back and see actually the nutrients in the same crops grown over the last 50 years. And the kernel of truth, yes, there has been crop depletion, but we're talking over the last half century on the order of 15%. So yeah, six florets of broccoli, you know, five florets of broccoli in the 1950s. Has the same nutrition as six florets of broccoli now. But the answer is not to take a pill, trace mineral pill, but to just eat an extra floret of broccoli. Fine, eat some more good food. That's great. But there's this sense that somehow our soil is completely stripped. That's impossible. These nutrients are in the plant, not by chance. They're actually used by the plant to grow. They have physiological functions in the plant. If you really had that little in the soil, you would have no plant. The fact that there actually is a plant means that there's enough nutrition to support that plant. So for example, chlorophyll, that, you know, what makes, you know, green leaves green, the center of every chlorophyll molecule is a magnesium atom. That's where you want to look where magnesium is found. You look for things that are green, right? And so there's only a certain, you need a certain amount of magnesium. If the plant is green, it's got magnesium. And it would not grow, it would not be able to grow if it didn't have that. So that's why it's really an overstatement. And we don't need to go to the supplement aisle to get our nutrition. We can stick to the produce aisle. We just have to have to eat a few extra bites these days.
Very good, very good. I love your angle on looking at all this and your perspective. It really does make a ton of sense, and it's so contrary to what we normally hear or read in the media. So thank you for that. You know, obviously right now we're still hopefully at the tail end, but still in the midst of the COVID pandemic. Is the same plant-based diet good for everything, even including boosting our immunity?
Well, I mean, the way diet will help us the most in terms of the pandemic is the underlying risk factors for disability and death. So think about them. It is type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, obesity, and heart disease. Those are the four leading modifiable risk factors for COVID-19 severity and death. And guess what? Every single one of them, 4 out of 4, is not just preventable, arrestable, but reversible with a healthy enough plant-based diet. And in fact, look, you don't even have to be obese. Even having a BMI of 28 puts you at nearly 6 times the odds of suffering a severe COVID-19 course. The average BMI in the United States, 29. So being skinnier than the average American could still put you at so much excess body fat that you're 6 times as likely to suffer a severe course. You know, but look, you know, how many months into this thing are we, right? If people started cleaning up their diet and, you know, getting an exercise program going and starting taking better care of themselves, you know, by now there's no excuse why you wouldn't be able to fortify yourself against this disease.
Beautiful. In the plant-based diet, Dr. Greger, are there certain key herbs or spices people should be utilizing and consuming as well?
Oh, I'm so glad you bring that up. Yeah, I mean, there are plant foods and then there are plant foods, right? There are some that are healthier than others, right? So iceberg lettuce, definitely a plant, but there are healthier options for your salad out there. So that's where my daily dozen concept came from. The daily dozen checklist of all the healthiest of healthy foods. I encourage people to try to fit into their daily routine. And so, for example, fruit is great, but berries are better. Berries are the healthiest fruits. So I encourage people to eat berries every day. All vegetables are great, but dark green leafy vegetables are the best of the best. So I encourage people to eat them every day. And a quarter teaspoon of turmeric, a tablespoon of ground flax seeds every day, the best beverages, the best sweetener, how much exercise to get every day. Again, just trying to inspire people to move towards some of these healthier options. And it's available free as an app on iPhone and Android. Dr. Greger's Daily does. And you can, you know, graph your progress and go through the checklist every day. And just kind of a fun way to try to encourage people to eat some of the healthiest foods.
Beautiful. Would you mind sharing most or some of the Daily Dozen with us?
Sure. Oh my God, can I do it all from, that's why I have an app. I don't have to memorize any of this. Greens, healthiest vegetables, berries, healthiest fruits, legumes, so beans, split peas, chickpeas, and lentils. I did the quarter teaspoon of turmeric, the tablespoon of ground flax seeds. Recommend 90 minutes of moderate exercise every day. That's what the literature suggests is best for longevity. The healthiest beverages would be green tea, hibiscus tea, an herbal tea called hibiscus tea or water. How am I doing? I think we're up to 7. Well, there's 5 more. Check out the app.
I don't mean to put you on the spot. You did great. You did great. And let's even drill down deeper if we can. Even in the world of berries, there's so many different types of berries. Are raspberries better than blackberries? Are blueberries the best of the bunch? Where should we be focused?
Blackberries win the day. So blackberries are the most antioxidant-packed common berry. There are some exotic berries with Dr. Seussian and names like whortleberries and things like that. But in terms of what you can buy at your local store, yeah, blackberries really do seem to be best. But actually, most of the research on the benefits of berries, we think it's these anthocyanin compounds, these pigment compounds, antioxidant pigment compounds concentrated in berries that give them those bright colors like reds and purples and blacks that are so beneficial. But the studies was done on like the Harvard Nurses Health study in terms of significant improvement in brain health was blueberries and strawberries, kind of the most really? Kind of mundane of berries. But because we think it's these anthocyanin compounds, the most concentrated sources of those are the kind of the darker, the better. And that's why these blackberries and black raspberries really rise to the top.
Beautiful. And how about something like pomegranate?
Oh, fantastic. Exactly. Has those same anthocyanin pigments. You can see it right in the pigment, right? So it's like a whole, you got a whole bowl full of berries. And you have all sorts of fat-soluble nutrients actually found in the seeds when you chew them up. So, oh yeah, pomegranates are fantastic.
Beautiful. And even if we take a slight detour, how about the value of drinking like good red wine?
Well, even good red grapes. How about that?
Better.
better. So, so if you are going to drink alcohol, the best choice would be red wine. I mean, that's the only alcoholic beverages that has not been tied, and this is in the large Harvard cohorts, to increased risk of breast cancer. Even light drinking, defined as 0 to 1 drinks per day in women, significantly increases breast cancer risk, with the exception of red wine. We think it's because of these aromatase inhibitor compounds found in the skins of grapes, which are included in the use of red wine, but not other alcoholic beverages. Which may impair the tumor's ability to create its own estrogen to kind of fuel its own growth. There's also those compounds found in white mushrooms, for example, or you can eat the grapes themselves. And so then you just have the benefits. And so in red wine, the alcohol is increasing your cancer risk, but the grape skin compounds are decreasing it, so you get a neutral effect. Okay, but why not just go to all the benefits without the risk by, eating some table grapes?
Beautiful, beautiful. My last question for you, but quite frankly, because we're in the Practice Upgrade Summit, might be my most important for our listeners, even though everything you shared has just been awesome and spot on and very inspiring and thought-provoking. Doc, what's the best way for a doctor to upgrade his or her practice with nutrition based on all the work you've done?
Well, depending on one's practice, may encourage people to bring on auxiliary staff. It doesn't have to be a dietitian, it can be a health coach, but there's a lot there in terms of not just informing people about the best diet, but actually, how to fit it into their lifestyle. I mean, there are some practices that have people that actually go to people's houses, go through their pantry, go help them shop, really to get them all set up. I mean, that's the really kind of, it's the practical how-to tips that often as medical practitioners, we just don't have the time to go kind of to fully inform. And so we can be like, we can be the ones that lay down the law and say, look, based on the blood work we just got back or whatever testing, you really need to eat this way. And to help you do that, I want you to make an appointment, with this person, and they can help you achieve this. And then let's see you back, return and repeat that blood work. If you're able to do that, I think that's really the best of both worlds. Unfortunately, too often, we just tell people kind of what to eat, but not exactly how to do it. Or even worse, we just be like, you got to eat better. Some ridiculous, vague, that's not going to help anybody. But even if you're very specific, look, I want you to, cut out the soda, and I want you to, people are like, well, what am I going to do instead? They could be like, oh, do you know about these seltzer machines? Do you know about all these other things you can drink to kind of wean yourself off? And, there's a lot of practical day-to-day grocery store type tips that can help people make a transition more effortlessly, make the default options healthier options, get some good healthy snacking options to replace some of the junk that they're eating. But, you know, it's not the best use of our time and expertise, but certainly, you know, bringing on coaches can help actually get the results. Kale, the healthiest food in the world, dark green leafy vegetables, are useless if it's just going to rot in your crisper. It only helps when you actually eat it. So we got to make it delicious for people. And it's hard to do that in a, 15-minute appointment.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for that. So listen, if this conversation with Dr. Michael Greger got you thinking, please go to nutritionfacts.org. Check out his 2000 plus and growing videos, his research, his material. Go out and buy his books, you know, How Not to Die, How Not to Die Cookbook, and How Not to Diet. They're all just terrific. Before we conclude, Dr. Greger, any parting comments for the doctors watching this? Any words of wisdom, pearls of wisdom you want to leave them with?
Well, I have a new cookbook coming out, How Not to Diet Cookbook, in December. And I just want to leave everyone with the good news that we have tremendous power over our health, destiny, and longevity. The vast majority of premature death and disability is preventable with a plant-based diet and other healthy lifestyle behaviors.
You are a rock star and a gem, and thank you so much. I know how crazy busy you are. You actually had to fit in this interview during part of your 90 minutes of exercise, and I appreciate it. The fact that you were able to remain so focused and so calm and so wise while you're working out on your treadmill is a gift. You are a gift. So thank you so much for contributing to our summit and for helping our doctors help their patients even more, which is what it's all about, isn't it?
Fantastic. Anytime. Keep up the good work.
Same to you. And you have yourself an awesome day. Thank you.